This is Connected to Chicago with Bill Cameron.
What's going on in Chicago? What the hell is going on?
Covering the big ideas.
Is the mayor full of crap or is it real?
The tough choices.
Guacamole? No, I like guacamole.
The farce.
Let's get right down to nut cutting.
And corruption.
I've got this thing and it's golden.
Plus special reports and newsmaker interviews along with the esteemed panel of reporters. And now, Bill Cameron.
Troy LaRavier is here. He's one of the challengers to Mayor Emanuel in the city elections in February. Troy, welcome back to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Some folks won't know you, so we should begin with, who is Troy LaRavier?
I am an award-winning former Chicago public school principal. I led the number one ranked neighborhood school in the city. It was not number one when I got there, but it was when I left. Received multiple awards from the mayor himself for my work. And as I was doing that work, it became increasingly difficult because of budget cuts that we began to see as traceable to consistent, unceasing corruption in CPS in the mayor's office. I remember Barbara Bird Bennett, our former CEO, having a contract with a company she used to work for, paid them $20 million in the same year where she cut millions of dollars from our budgets. And I remember sitting around the table with principals who were complaining about it. And I said, we should get up and say something, because we had gone to this training for this company that she had paid $20 million to. And we knew it was horrible. And we knew that $20 million came directly out of our budgets for things that, and we had to get rid of things that our kids needed. And I said, we should say something about this. And they looked at me like and said, clearly, aren't you afraid of losing your job? And my response is that I didn't get into education for a job. I got into education for a purpose. And that was to make sure our kids realize their God-given potential. And this administration's corruption was making our efforts to get them to realize their potential more and more difficult. And so I began to speak out. I spoke out at City Hall. I wrote op-eds that got published in the Chicago Sun-Times and the Chicago Tribune. I was the first and only Chicago public school principal to expose that contract, which she eventually went to prison for, even before the FBI investigated it. I looked at it, said it was corrupt, wrote it publicly, and risked my job to do so because she was still the CEO and no one else was out there saying this. And so I think the city needs someone who is, we all too often have politicians who are willing to sacrifice others for their own personal gain. And we need a person in the mayor's office who is willing to sacrifice their own position for the gain of the people they represent. And I think I'm the only person in the race that has exemplified that and demonstrated that ability to sacrifice my own position, sacrifice my own personal gain for the betterment of the people in this city.
During that period when B3 was corrupt, did you ever get the sense that the mayor knew of it or later tried to cover it up?
Absolutely, he knew of it. Sarah Karp wrote about it quite extensively. The inspector general investigated it. And I remember when I wrote my piece, the press hounded him about my piece because it was the first time a sitting principal had openly criticized him. And in criticizing him, I also picked the corrupt and incompetent people that he put in charge of CPS. And I specifically laid out that contract for that horrible training, that $20 million no-bid contract. And so he got hounded by the press and wouldn't, I don't think he responded for 4 days. And as usual, it was just one of his flippant comments that's designed to obfuscate and just get past the reporters on to the next thing. And so he certainly knew about it because he was hounded about it. And he did not lift a finger to go after her. It took federal intervention from the FBI, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, to get her out. Never lifted a finger.
So you would argue he ignored it, but did you ever get the sense he covered it up?
Absolutely. I think he covered it up as much as he covered up the Laquan McDonald incident.
How so?
I mean, he's the mayor. He is notorious for micromanagement. He controls that office, the mayor's office, controls everything that's said and done in every department that this city has. It is naive, beyond naive, to think there's something of that magnitude going on in any department that office did not know about. And if they knew about it and didn't say anything about it, which we know is the truth, then that is cover up. That is a cover up.
Isn't that too stupid to do by a very smart man, Rahm Emanuel?
No. I mean, he's gotten away with it. I mean, he should be in pinstripes right now, but he's still the city mayor of our city. He seems to know how to weather a storm, to talking point his way through a storm, and move on to the next crisis. It's almost as if the crises help him in some way, because the next crisis makes people forget about the last crisis. The next corrupt scandal clouds people's minds and memories about the last corrupt scandal. And he's pretty adept at it.
He should be in pinstripes?
Yes. I mean, the Chicago Tribune had a front page article in 2015. And the lead of the article, the headline was, Rahm Emanuel's Political Cash Machine. And in that article, they had done a serious, in-depth investigation of both his calendar, his schedule, and his political donations, and the contracts that the city gave out. And 60 of his top 100 contributors all got some kind of contract or benefit from our tax dollars. Millions of dollars flowing from our coffers, tax dollars, to the corporations that fund his campaign. It is legalized theft of grand proportions. And then, of course, there's the Laquan McDonald incident. You know, one of the things about that incident, before I go on, is to say one of the things I don't like about how that incident is framed is that he's going to lose black support. That somehow, because Laquan McDonald was black and he hid the murder of this young black boy, that black people are not going to vote for him. Laquan McDonald was a human being, right? And if you are a human being, you should be disgusted by both what happened to him and disgusted by the attempt to cover up what happened to him. You know, they say he'll lose black votes. He should lose all votes. But the last time I checked, if you help someone commit a crime, you are an accomplice to that crime. If you help someone, or an accessory to that crime, if you help someone cover a crime up after the crime is committed, the legal definition is an after-the-fact accessory to that crime. And so if you help someone cover up a murder, then you are an after-the-fact accessory to that murder, and you should be standing trial, sitting next to them in the courtroom, facing the same charges they face.
He denied that he sat on the video before the election.
I think that should be a question left to a jury. I think there should be a trial. You know, I'm not a judge and jury, but I think there should be a judge and jury, right? I think that there should be a trial, that there should be an investigation, that all of the evidence should be collected with the authority that a trial gives attorneys to collect evidence, and that question should be left to a jury. But he's not in front of a jury. He's still on the fifth floor of City Hall. How in the hell is that possible? How is he still our mayor after that? And yet he is.
Troy, why do you want to be mayor in particular?
Because I don't think we have a mayor. The city of Chicago does not have a mayor. Goldman Sachs has a mayor. Bank of America has a mayor. The venture and vulture capitalists, they all have a mayor. Henry Feinberg, he has a mayor. Does that name sound familiar to you?
Yes.
So he's the guy who had an exchange with Rahm Emanuel on email that was later, he was later forced to release based on a Freedom of Information Act request. And in that email, Henry Feinberg is arguing for more cuts to city workers' pensions and public pensions in general. And Rahm Emanuel responds to that argument by bragging about the fact that he not only cut city workers, retired city workers, healthcare benefits, he eliminated. He says that I am the only mayor to eliminate benefits that were earned by public employees. And he's bragging about it to Henry Feinberg because he's Henry Feinberg's mayor. He is not the mayor of those city employees. I mean, these people took bullets for those benefits. These people ran into burning buildings for those benefits. And he's bragging about the fact that he sent them all into poverty by eliminating their healthcare benefits. They don't have a mayor. I want to be their mayor. I want to be the mayor for people like them, hundreds of thousands of people like them all across this city. The young children at the National Teachers Academy who are getting their school taken out from underneath them. It's a level, it has the highest rating CPS has, right? It is fully enrolled. It doesn't meet any of the requirements or the so-called justifications for closure. And yet, because a wealthy subset of residents in the South Loop, they call themselves the Prairie Alliance, and again, shown in emails between them and him, they said, we want that building. Right? And he is disrupting and destroying a tight-knit school community to give that wealthy group that building so that they can have their high school at the expense of those kids, keeping their tight-knit, high-performing, fully enrolled school. Those kids don't have a mayor. Those families don't have a mayor. Schools like them, those four schools on the south side that he's shutting down, their families, those students, those communities, they don't have a mayor. And I want to be their mayor. I want to be the mayor of people who want their neighborhood schools invested in all over this city, no matter what side they're in. I just talked to a woman I was in Springfield giving testimony. And when I finished my testimony, she ran out after me because she knew I was running for mayor. And she said, you have to know my story. I want you to tell my story. And she is moving to Georgia, leaving Chicago and moving to Georgia for schools. Right? She has a son who's mildly autistic, high functioning, but cannot get the services for that young man that she needs in Chicago public schools because of the policy changes that they've made to make it impossible to delay and deny special education services to her child. And this is happening all over the city. Those kids don't have a mayor, and I want to be their mayor.
We're talking issues with Troy LaRavia, one of the challengers to Mayor Emanuel. I think you've guessed by now. I'm guessing, Troy, you're for an elected school board.
I am for a representative and competent school board, whether it's elected or appointed. And this is what I mean by that. That if you look at the local school councils, for example, they have criteria. You can't just run for a local school council. You have to be a parent. If you have to be a parent, then that ensures that you're representative because you have a stake in the school. You can be a teacher at the school. That ensures you have some kind of educational competence from your training as a teacher. The principal, that ensures some educational competence. A community member from within that school's attendance boundary. That criteria ensures that there is representation, that it is representative of the community or the school that or the community area that the school serves. And so I think we should have similar criteria in elected school board legislation that ensures that there is representation. And another thing is that I think the smaller the districts, it cannot be at large. If it's at large, that means you're going to need millions of dollars to run. And if you need millions of dollars to run, then only people who can get millions of dollars are going to succeed in getting elected. And so it's how they structure the elected school board that matters even more so than whether it's elected or appointed. And so when I am elected, I am committing to having those kinds of criteria. If we don't have an elected school board when I'm elected, then I'm going to work with community members across this city to establish the criteria by which I will be held responsible for selecting the members of the school board. And if we're able to get elected school board legislation, then I will push extremely hard to ensure those kinds of criteria are included in that legislation.
How would you transform Chicago Public Schools, and where would you get the money to do it?
So the two things. And so when I went into Blaine, there were two broad areas that we looked at, instruction and curriculum, that we had to build the capacity of teachers to teach. All too often, we emphasize accountability, punishing people for not meeting standards without lifting a finger to build their capacity to meet them in the first place. And so training, in-service, research-based methods that are shown to improve the teacher's capacity to improve student capacity. The next thing is curriculum. We have, one, raising the level of rigor in the curriculum for all students, but also broadening the curriculum. We and CPS have been trained to look at schooling through the lens of test scores in two subject areas, and to think our students are gaining or doing well if those test scores, no matter how low they are creeping up. Now, I went over, my son was enrolled at the University of Chicago Lab School for a summer program. He's at our neighborhood public school during the year. But my wife enrolled him at the University of Chicago Lab School for a summer program. I go to pick him up, and he's at the Gordon Parks Media Lab taking a documentary film course in fourth grade. And then I look at their curriculum, and they have dance, they have drama, they have painting, they have sculpture, they have world cuisines. Everyone learns a language: Mandarin, Spanish, French, German. That's a curriculum designed to produce full human beings, to develop full human beings. That is how I would transform Chicago Public Schools, by broadening both the curriculum and improving teachers' ability and capacity to teach it. And in terms of the money, that's a two-part answer. And so there are many different proposals out there in terms of pushing this, the city resources we control, and there's pushing the state, right? Those are the two things that folks have been talking about. And improving the state, pushing for the state to fund the new funding formula. They've changed the funding formula, but now they have to actually generate the revenue to fund, to get it up to an adequate level where it makes a difference. And they've talked about pushing for progressive revenue to do that. They've also talked about expanding the sales tax to include services to generate more revenue. Folks have talked about reinstituting the corporate head tax. But before we do any of that, we have to ensure, you know, I learned a lesson from Toni Preckwinkle, and I have respect for Toni Preckwinkle. And I think she talked openly about this lesson as well, in terms of you can pick any tax you want, but if you don't do the work of getting public buy-in to that revenue, talking about the need for it, going through all of the options with them, you may or may not be successful. And so before we start talking about raising the revenue, we have to talk about instituting. There were two things that doomed that tax: the lack of public buy-in and the perception that the public had in terms of there was this waste in the county government. The soda industry was able to create this perception that there are these things that folks could cut. And so to some extent, that could be true. So in city revenue, we have to institute policies. I think Dick Simpson, in the book Chicago Is Not Broke, said that we pay $500 million in corruption taxes every year. We have to ensure that the public knows that we have gotten rid of that $500 million of waste and corruption. And then institute policies that ensure we can't do it anymore. I've actually reached out to two organizations that have as their goal to end corruption in government, to end waste in government, and asked them for 10 of their recommendations. 10 recommendations for the newly elected mayor to institute policy suit to institute to ensure that our government is as corruption free as possible. And at first, they didn't want to cooperate and give me any recommendations because they said, you're a candidate for mayor. I said, you don't just give them to me. Put them out there for the public to see and then push each candidate to take a position on every single one of these recommendations for ending corruptions to see where they stand, because I know I'm going to adopt all of them as mayor. And so people will see you've stopped the waste. You've gotten rid of the waste that's there. And you've also adopted these policies to prevent waste in the future. Now we can begin to have a conversation about revenue, because now you have a government that you can trust in terms of giving up your hard-earned dollars to meet our public goals.
Sounds like the BGA, is that the organization you asked?
I have reached out to the BGA, and I have reached out to, I had a quick conversation with Ralph Martiri several months ago. And I remember Ralph said, you know what? They had opposite responses. Ralph said, I'd have that conversation with you, and I'd also do the same with Rahm. He said, that's why we exist. We exist because we want government to adopt our recommendations.
Okay,
the BGA said something a little bit different. Because they are press, a journalistic organization, they were a little wary about getting involved in it in any way whatsoever. But, you know, we'll see.
We talk most about schools, but we should also talk about the police department. What would a Chicago police department, how would it be transformed under a LaRavier administration?
So, again, you got this talk about accountability, but you also have capacity building. If you look at the Department of Justice and their report, they had three major findings. There was really a fourth one, but one is that there is a pattern and practice of unconstitutional use of force. That's number one. Two, that there is a substantive lack of accountability measures to deal with that pattern and practice of unconstitutional use of force. And three, that their training, supervision, and support for police officers is also severely lacking. And so I would institute, I would basically follow those three, follow the first one is sort of a description of what is. The second two point to remedies. You have to have accountability systems, but you also have to be able to build the capacity of officers to meet the goals by which you are holding, or the standards by which you are holding them accountable. So that means everything from policing strategies to helping them recognizing the prejudices or unconscious prejudices and biases by which that all of us have, including them. But all of us don't get to carry guns and police the people that we have prejudices against. And so it's extremely important for police officers and teachers, because of the power you have in terms of how you interact with the public and how you can impact someone's life based on your unconscious prejudices and biases, it's more important that you be trained to recognize them and move past them than just about anybody else in the population.
That's Troy LaRavier. Thanks for coming in to talk issues.
Thank you for having me.
And may the best person win.
He will.
After a break, our roundtable with Lynn Sweet, Ray Long, and Greg Hines, along with Fran Spielman as well, after this.
Connected to Chicago, a look at the top stories of the week with the people making, covering, and talking about the news of the day. Podcasts are available online at WLSAM.com. Now, Bill Cameron.
Time for the roundtable, where we just get to tell the truth with, there's Lynn Sweet at the Sun-Times out in Washington. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, Bill.
Ray Long of the Tribune here in the studio.
Hello there, Bill.
Greg Hines of Cranes here, too.
Sir.
And Fran Spielman over at the City Hall Press Room. She works for the Sun-Times. Hi, Franny.
Hey.
Well, just as we're sitting down to talk, Lynn, White House is announcing that the president is, as previewed, giving a pardon to Scooter Libby. So tell the folks who Scooter Libby is and what message Trump is sending with this.
Well, Scooter Libby was the chief of staff to Vice President Dick Cheney, who got caught up in what was known as the CIA leak case that exposed a CIA undercover operative by the name of Valerie Plame. Now, he was convicted in 2007. President Bush cut his his prison sentence, but he did not give him a pardon. You know, there are various ways you could give various forms of clemency. So what, in a statement that Trump said today in granting this, he said that he always thought that 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 Scooter Libby was treated unfairly. So this is a big signal to three people mainly that are under the microscope of investigator special counsel Bob Mueller. This would be Michael Flynn, this would be Paul Manafort, and Jared Kushner, Trump's son-in-law.
Would it also suggest anything about Rod Blagojevich if he's so freewheeling with the use of pardons? What do you think?
Well, I think now, you know, when you mention it, Blagojevich has another matter up before the Supreme Court right now. And it is not clear what the Supreme Court would do, but he has some other swings left at bat. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't take this as any foreshadowing of what could happen to Blagojevich. And, you know, I don't even know if this would be on the White House radar. President Trump is consumed with this Mueller investigation. The FBI coming in to take records from his attorney, Michael Cohen, shook him and the White House up this week because it's just not clear what kind of records or recordings might be there. And Trump even, through his attorney, showed up in a court in New York on Friday morning to try and limit what the FBI could use from the stuff taken from Cohen.
Yeah, it has been a remarkable week on the Trump story. What do you think, Greg, of the new book just out, Attacking Trump, to which he accuses the author of being a slimeball?
Well, I have not had a chance to read it yet. My copy must have been lost in the mail.
Didn't get one.
The TV stars got one, but like I said, mine got slipped. But from what I can tell, it's a gossipy, chatty, go for the jugular. That he went a little bit further than I thought. I mean, comparing the size of his hand to Trump's, I thought was a bit rich. But this guy clearly is a little bit of a showboater. He likes to, he wants to sell some books, so he let it rip. unfortunately for us, I suspect that a lot of the stuff he said was true, particularly his description about how all Trump wanted to talk about when they first met wasn't Russian involvement and what we're going to do to stop it and how bad was it, but what the hookers did to each other on the bed. I'm not sure if we can go into details on this family radio station or not, but everybody's talking about it. This is kind of, psychologically, this is the capper for an unbelievably awful week for this president. I really am starting to reach the opinion that he's lost it. I mean, he's obsessed with this investigation. He flip-flops on TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Did ever see he's going to be, after pulling us down, he says he wants back in because apparently he wants to take care of American farmers who are going to lose out with these China tariffs that may or may not come. And then he all but puts his finger on the button to shoot missiles at Syria, and then he says, well, maybe we won't do it right now. I mean, this guy it's utter chaos right now.
Franny, what do you think of a former FBI director writing a tell-all book?
Well, I don't know. Am I the only one who thinks it's a bit unseemly to have an FBI director writing a tell-all book? I know these are different times, vastly different times, and all the old rules don't apply. But in my mind, an FBI director, the chief law enforcement officer for the United States of America, ought not be writing tell-all books no matter what his boss does.
Ray?
Well, I just want to quote the Daily News headline, Pea Brain, Comey Book Bombshell. That was, just driving it a little bit crazy here. And it talks about how Trump was obsessed with alleged video the one we're talking about with the Russian hookers that is alleged to have happened in the... in the tawdry tape.
I have to say, though, I think Freddie has a point. We do live in different times, but it's really hard to feel sorry for Donald Trump, given how many people he has slimed.
Yeah. Lynn, as the pro-chaos president continues down this road, what do you sense on Capitol Hill about his Republican support as we see even Paul Ryan deciding not to seek re-election?
Soon it will be every member of Congress for him or herself. The hold that Republicans have on the House isn't helped with the announcement of Paul Ryan that he's not going to run for re-election. It also, so here are the storylines that all make it harder to govern, not easier. The House right now, run by the Republicans, are starting already their own internal campaign to see who's going to replace Paul Ryan. There's even some who think, including Adam Kinzinger, the Republican who serves in the district just south of the city of Chicago, that maybe they ought to have elections to replace Ryan as early as this summer. So when you say it's a pro-chaos president, this chaos is everywhere right now because we're getting closer to the midterm campaigns every day. And there is nothing that's happened that's making it easier for Republicans to keep the House. They only need 23 seats lost and they lose it.
Yeah, Franny, I see a blue wave coming. Do you?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely, and I'm sure Paul Ryan saw that too. I mean, he doesn't want to preside over the minority. His job was difficult enough before, and appeasing all the factions in the Republican Party. I'm not surprised at all that he left. I mean, these rumors have been flying for months. But, you know, there's just such an angry mood among the electorate out there, and people are just, you know, I think anybody who's putting their name on the ballot, whether it's in the mayoral election or in the aldermanic election next year or in November, they've got to be scared to death of the voters.
Mm-hmm. Ray?
Yeah, there's no question. This is not your mom and dad's electorate out there. There is not just anger, but there's disgust. There's a throw the bums out, no matter who the bum is, whether they're good or bad. There's a throw the bums out attitude. And Franny's right that there is just this idea that running by putting your name up there right now, you never know what's going to happen.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Springfield. I see the governor's approval rating, Greg, is down in one poll to 26%. How do you read that?
I read that Bruce Rauner has not yet recovered from the budget fiasco. 2 years without a budget, 2.5 years, which absolutely wrecked the state's credit, gave job employers a great reason to go somewhere else, gave a lot of people a reason to move. Then on top of that, he gets in this fight with Jeanne Ives in the primary. It's where he's alienated a good part of his base. Democrats didn't like him. Now half his own party doesn't like him. You know, no election is over this far away, but man, J.B. Pritzker, the Democratic nominee, is going to have to work overtime to blow this thing.
Yeah, but J.B. comes out like Mondale at the 84 convention when Mondale said, "We got taxes to raise." You know, J.B. Pritzker wanting to raise your taxes in various ways, Ray, suggests that maybe Rauner has a chance?
Well, maybe. You do have to remember that Rauner ran against Governor Quinn, and the electorate was tired of Quinn. And Quinn was making it clear that he wanted to raise the income tax, and he had specific numbers he wanted to raise it. And Quinn was also in after Blagojevich. People gave Quinn a quickie election once he came in and replaced Blagojevich, but he didn't really gain the electorate's confidence, and people were looking for a change. They thought, you know, something's got to happen here. So it's going to be difficult for Rauner to try to duplicate a victory out of his mess that he's getting himself into now.
Lynn, would you give Rauner a chance based upon J.B. sounding like Mondale?
Oh, I just think in time that will be irrelevant. We're so far out of figuring out what will make the undecideds or the persuadables or the swing voters, make a decision. This is a race where it's just really probably going to be a handful of people who are being fought over. And the what's going on now is that candidate Browner and Pritzker have got to figure out what will motivate their base to stay engaged and vote, but what can they do to expand that base?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if what happened just in the last few days is really going to be determinative of anything, because there's going to be so many more messages and so much more time before this thing gets down to somebody actually voting.
The rebellion of conservatives, though, in this primary is going to be very difficult for Rauner to try to patch up. A lot of times you lose a conservative base and you have trouble pulling that back in November.
Yeah, I'll tell you how hard it is. Bruce Rauner and Jeannie Ives actually ran into each other at a Springfield restaurant during the week. And as Rauner tells the story, she was at a table. He came over. He said hello. They shook hands. And, well, we promised that we'd get together real soon, presumably to talk peace.
Mm-hmm.
But according to Jeannie Ives, the governor said hi, shook her hand, and kept walking. And when I asked her, well, is it true that you're going to get together with him and talk peace? Is that a lie? And she says, if he says that, yes. So that's how far they are, a month after the primary, from even beginning to try to heal the Republican wounds.
The relationship between Rauner and Rahm was interesting this week, as Rahm pressures the legislature to override Rauner's veto of the gun shop licensing bill, which will, well, we don't know that it's going to happen, but it might. But in this episode, Fran, even the mayor was throwing catfish at Rauner, arguing that, well, he was signing a bill last year to regulate catfish sales in restaurants, but now he's against regulating gun shop dealers. How do you see this one playing out, Franny?
Well, I don't know what the votes are like in Springfield, but the mayor must have strained to come up with that one. You know how they prepare for these sessions with the media, and they try to find alliterations and different comparisons that they can use to make their point. And so they made the point that the governor signed on to that bill about regulating catfish sales at restaurants, and why would he possibly think that this is overregulation? The governor's response is that he wants a more comprehensive, school safety, public safety plan, and not a feel-good thing that's just something that will have really little effect. I can't tell. The mayor seems to think that this is going to come down to a couple of Republican DuPage County lawmakers who have female opponents, and that they can somehow pressure those guys to come over. It'll probably be tough, like all gun legislation is in Springfield.
And Greg, it was also interesting to see the richest man in Illinois, Ken Griffin, standing up with Rahm after Griffin gave, what, $25 million to Rauner in the last campaign. Explain this relationship, Ken Griffin and Rahm Emanuel.
Well, Ken Griffin, like a lot of fairly rich folks, likes to have contribute to charity. He likes to do some good. I mean, he doesn't want to be thought of as just this rich hedge fund guy. And one of the things he gave money to, in this case, $10 million, is a program run by the University of Chicago Crime Lab in conjunction with the city. It actually seems to be having a real effect on the murder rate and the shooting rate in Chicago. What it does is it combines the latest analytical data techniques to allow micro-targeting so that cops out on the patrol in their car, they can get a note right away from headquarters, go over here, if this is the neighborhood where the stuff is happening right now. It's a much better system than they've had in the past. And they've tried it in a couple of districts for about the last year, and the results have been wonderful, like 50% cut in shootings. And they're slowly rolling it out. It's now into about half the districts in the city. But it costs money. They don't have money. And so Griffin has given this money to the crime lab so they can continue to do this very promising work with CPD.
Mm-hmm. Franny, it is.
Some of that money is going to an early intervention program to try to highlight police officers who have a lot of complaints against them and need help before they have a bad shooting. This is something that's been promised literally for years, and they still don't have it. And the question is why. So some of Griffin's money is going to come up with that, hopefully. But it's been promised for so long, I'd like to see it.
It's a really great idea, too.
And the relationship...
Is this going to the fund that Manuel created after the murder of Hidea Pendleton?
No.
He was doing whatever. This is a different one.
It's not the first time that Griffin has stepped in. Remember, his money also, $12 million, helped separate the lakefront bike trails into separate paths.
It is an interesting relationship. And, Ray, the relationship between Rauner and Speaker Madigan was interesting this week, with Madigan coming out of a budget meeting with the four tops and the governor and attacking Rauner outright. You know, vowing not to go along with any more cuts and asking Rauner to leave the budget to the people who are serious about it.
Yeah, it's more of the dance that people are sick of, but it is also Madigan's belief that they just have to go in there and do something and get it done and move on. And of course, he hopes to win some political points out of this, too. And it doesn't hurt him to gig Rauner back every once in a while after Rauner has spent seemingly, it seems like billions, but he's spent millions of dollars in ads attacking Madigan.
I don't know, Ray. Do you think we're going to get a budget deal this year? I hear an awful lot of chatter among Democrats that, maybe we ought to just let the thing crash and everybody will blame Rauner.
Yeah, it'll go whatever way they think they can win the most political points. And a lot of times they don't decide that until the last week or so. So it would not surprise me that they don't get one. If they get a half a budget or something like that, they can say, well, J.B. Pritzker will be the governor and we'll fix it halfway through the year.
You mean it's not about good government?
Sometimes that slips by and gets in the way, but, most of the time...
You forgot to mention the other half is good politics.
That's Greg Hines of Cranes, thanks to him, and to Ray Long of the Tribune. Also to Lynn Sweet of the Sun-Times out in Washington and Fran Spielman at the City Hall Press Room. After a break, Jennifer Kuiper.
Connected to Chicago. Podcasts are available online at WLSAM.com.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper. The government's March jobs report was lower than expectations and showed the smallest gain in 6 months, but came after a very strong February. Mark Hamrick with BankRate.com joins us to talk about it. Welcome, Mark.
Hello, Jennifer.
A weaker than expected report, but not exactly a disappointing one, right?
Absolutely, and I think that the weakness, unless we start getting a series of reports that show us lower hiring than expected, I think this is probably a one-month blip, and that is really only of keen interest to short-term investors or professional investors. What happened was that we, in February, had more than 300,000 jobs added in the U.S. economy, and this month we got basically just a little more than 100,000. So this month was less robust than hoped for, but you take a look at some trends over the course of 2017, basically 175,000 jobs added a month. In the past 3 months, we've had an average of 202,000 jobs added. And so you do expect these numbers to bounce around, and I just add one more big number in there, and that is, when we miss this number by 100,000 or so, that's in the context of roughly 5 to 6 million jobs every month that are seeing people being hired. About 6 million people are hired in the U.S. every month. So, it almost ends up being a rounding error. But, if you're an investor, it's time to make money on these things, or hopefully you don't lose money on it. But we think that also that there were some aspects that had to do with weather that plays into all this. We had a strong showing in construction hiring in February, March, not so much. We know over much of the country, March was sort of a miserable weather month. And, we still have an outlook for the first quarter that has growth at 2% or better. That's not the 3 to infinity number that the president likes to talk about. But, I think from a broader perspective, it's quite respectable for an economic expansion that began 9 years ago.
You mentioned construction hiring taking a hit because of the weather. What were some of the sectors that were strong?
I would say, first of all, that there weren't necessarily sectors that were killing it in this report, indicative of the fact that it was weaker than expected. But in terms of those that perhaps get an A for attendance, the goods producing sector, which is essentially, you know, traditionally we would think of it as so-called blue collar, that's been great here for any number of months now. And that includes manufacturing, construction, mining, oil drilling. In this month, manufacturing added 22,000, mining added, I believe, 9,000. It was construction, as we said, that gave some back, 15,000 to be exact. Business and professional services always has good attendance in these reports, adding 33,000 in this month. Retail gave some up, and we had seen a gain of nearly 50,000 in February. And you're in Chicago. The local firm, Challenger Gray and Christmas, which compiles essentially job cut announcements every month, they found that retail was, again, leading the way on job cut announcements recently. So it may be that we see some of that weakness in retail beginning to bleed into these reports. But I would expect probably, barring the truly unforeseen, that when we get the numbers for April coming up, that we should see probably some better showings for these sectors in general.
One of the things we've been keeping an eye on, wages. Wages are growing. I mean, there's some sign there that it's moving upward, but why are they not growing faster? What's holding them back?
Well, I think there's still some slack in the workforce, among other reasons, meaning we're probably drawing in some people from the sidelines. We had 800,000 people who basically jumped into the workforce in the February numbers. We gave just a slice of that up here in the March numbers. So presumably, if you're hiring somebody who's been unemployed or long-term unemployed, you don't have to pay them as much as if you're sort of pulling them from a would-be rival or, you know, a more compelling opportunity that you're competing with. But the other part is the long-term trends, and that is that we have baby boomers who are exiting the workforce and retiring. They are often supplanted by younger workers who do not command an equal wage, and you still have the issues of globalization, the ability to outsource, whether it's across the country or across the world, and the efficiencies that are associated with technology, where in some cases the technology can save on labor costs or even replace the labor itself.
Mark, I ask this question taking into consideration everything that has been going on recently, the tax bill, trade tariffs, upcoming midterm elections. Any changes in the forecast for the full year when it comes to hiring?
I don't think that anybody's cutting their employment forecast just yet for the full year, but if we do get into an escalating tariff situation, I think we'll be talking about that.
Mark Hamrick with Bankrate.com, thanks for joining us this week.
Jennifer, it's my great pleasure. Thanks so much.
For Connected to Chicago, I'm Jennifer Kuiper.
That's our show for this week. Thanks to Matt Mellon for production assistance. I'm Bill Cameron, WRLS News.
Connected to Chicago, a look at the top stories of the week with the people making, covering, and talking about the news of the day. Podcasts are available online at WLSAM.com.